This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Freedom of religion in America is guaranteed in the Bill of Rights, but it is being threatened in many high-profile law cases where it's bumping up against civil rights laws favoring homosexuals and transsexuals. We're going to talk with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about a Bible prophecy about the future of religious freedom in America. If you made a New Year's resolution this year, chances are you've already broken it by now. Why is it so hard for us to make permanent changes in our lives? We'll talk with trumpet writer Dennis Leap about the origins of New Year's resolutions, why they tend to fail, and how to approach self-improvement in a way that leads to greater success. What sort of food should you feed your baby? There are hundreds of different formulas and baby food products out there, but if you look at the ingredients, it's kind of shocking what these companies would have us feed our children. We'll talk with holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian about some of the dangers in store-bought baby food and how you can steer clear of these dangers and give your children the nutrition they need. And we'll conclude by talking about how to make the most of the most important meal of your day, the family dinner. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. In America today, there is a real war going on over freedom of religion. As more laws pass favoring homosexual and transsexual rights, it's putting those who consider these actions immoral in conflict with the law. They're having to choose between obeying human law and following their religion. You're aware of the Christian bakers in Oregon who refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. Recently, the Oregon Court of Appeals upheld a $135,000 fine against this couple. There are similar incidents occurring in other states and even in Britain. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Andrew Miller here in the studio. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
So can you just remind us about the details of this Oregon case?
Yeah, the Oregon case, we actually reported on it fairly extensively back in the January 2017 edition in an article entitled What's Going to Happen to Religious Freedom, where it talked about this couple that they owned a bakery in Oregon, and they had a homosexual couple, a lesbian couple, come in and request a wedding cake. And after they saw that it was two women's names going on the cake, they had to explain to them that, well, this is a Christian bakery. We don't support homosexual marriage, so you can buy whatever else you want in the shop, but we can't actually make you a wedding cake and participate in your wedding. Well, obviously, in the fact that they're chose this Christian bakery to make the request in the first place, offended by this, and they went to the state and filed a complaint, I think, with like 88 counts of emotional distress.
88 counts. That's a lot of emotional distress.
It's like shock and surprise and desire not to go to work. And
wow.
There's actually one of the more shocking things is it was actually never even tried in an actual court. It was tried by an administrative agency in Oregon. And they said, well, this is discriminatory against same-sex couples, so you now owe the state a $135,000 fine. And then they took it to the Oregon Appeals Court, to try to get that overturned, and it wasn't overturned. They're paying that $135,000 fine for refusing to bake this cake.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the administrative official who saw the case initially admitted that they said they did want to make this couple an example to other bakers in Oregon, to know that slap as big a fine as they can on them, to they know that if a homosexual couple asks them to bake them a cake, you better get your ingredients out and start work and get to work.
So maybe you can just break down the legal case that's being made here. Why is it that they would say a baker would absolutely have to make whatever anyone who came into their shop demanded that they make, that you know, by that logic, you would be able to demand that, say, they made a cake for just about any group out there, if, or somebody, maybe a Muslim, had to make something that was contrary to the dictates of their religion, it opens up a lot of ramifications that could potentially create other legal problems. But it's really been focused a lot on just the fact that Christianity and same-sex marriage rights, that these two, when they bump up against each other, we have to favor the one whose rights only came into existence in the last few years.
Right. And there's definitely a slippery slope to this argument with regards to, okay, well, does a Jew have to bake a cake with a swastika on it? And does a Muslim have to bake a cake with a cross on it, or vice versa? But the legal argument, as they're making, is that under the original U.S. Constitution, if it was your kitchen and your flour and your sugar and your eggs and you bake the cake, you could sell it or not sell it to whoever you wanted. In the 60s, about 1964, when they passed the Civil Rights Act, they were worried about discrimination based on race. And so they passed this act now saying that, well, you can't hang a no blacks allowed sign in your window. Mm-hmm. Even if it's your property, the government's now telling you you can't, based on either sex nor race. And just in the past several years, they've taken a lot of those state-level statutes, civil rights statutes, and added sexual orientation to a growing list. Well, now it's you can't discriminate race, sex, or sexual orientation. And so the current legal rationale is just really based on the idea that you're born homosexual. It's not like a behavior, but this is your identity, and to discriminate against someone who's homosexual is no different than discriminating against someone based on race or sex or something else. So that's the legal rationale they're trying to use to push this through. And you'll see in some of these cases, it is definitely politically motivated by the a very organized homosexual rights movement, and the fact that public support for homosexual marriage is more than 50% in the U.S. today. So it's not hard for a homosexual couple to find someone to bake them a cake. Mm-hmm. And in some of these cases, I don't know if it was particularly the case in this Oregon case, you'll find where they actually like go through the Yellow Pages or the internet or wherever and specifically look for Christian bakers that they know are going to have a problem with this, just to make a political statement.
Right. So what we see in more and more cases, and Stephen Fleury was talking about this yesterday on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, about situations where you have governments mandating that people use, say, the pronouns of someone's preference. And you know, you can say, well, it would be considered polite if someone said, you know, I would prefer that you refer to me as a she, even though biologically I'm a he, that the person would comply with that request. But you enter different territory when basically the government says you either use those pronouns or we're coming after you. And this type of situation you see happening more and more, where it's government coercion essentially mandating compliance with an individual's desire in this respect, regardless of their religious beliefs.
Right. And in some states, I think Massachusetts and Illinois come to mind, where they're even saying that you can't quote scriptures that speak negatively of homosexuality in a public place. Now, they said if you do it behind the closed doors of your church, that they won't stop you. But if you're in like a public square, like sometimes you see these street side preachers preaching, reading from the Bible, they said that, and someone who's homosexual might overhear you as he walks by.
Right.
That's against a state law. And now they use that like they try to use separation of church and state to justify that. But it's a very... it's a very like Marxist interpretation of separation of church and state. I mean, in the Soviet Union, which was officially atheist, that's pretty much what they said. It's like, oh, you can be Christian as long as you do it, you do your religious observance behind closed doors where no one could see or hear or think about you. But as soon as it's in public, the KGB or the Chico is going to shut you down.
Yeah. So other incidents that are taking place, I mean, these legal issues, they're really cropping up all over the place. Can you give us some other examples of cases where the freedom to practice your religion as you understand it is bumping up against the right to have a cake made wherever you may want it to be made?
Well, I mean, the cake and especially like florists and photographers as well, kind of having a very similar case to the cake thing where if, like, you have a wedding photographer, a wedding florist, a wedding cake maker, and now that homosexual marriage is becoming, or homosexual weddings is becoming such a big cause, they're targeting all three of those groups to try to get them to participate in those ceremonies. And this year is going to be big for America on how that goes, because right now most of this is being done at the state level. But there was the one, another high profile case, not from Oregon, but from Colorado, where they had a same thing. Baker refused to, make a cake for a homosexual wedding, and it's gone all the way to the Supreme Court.
Okay.
And so, and by the middle of this year, the court's going to make a ruling on it. It looks like Justice Anthony Kennedy is going to get to decide per usual, because they know that Gorsuch, Alito, Thomas, and Roberts are going to rule in favor of religious freedom.
Yeah.
And then the other four are going to rule in favor of don't discriminate against homosexuals.
Right.
But this is going to be something where, and it looks like in this case, it may be that Kennedy comes around and just rules in favor of religious freedom and has... But in a watered-down ruling that won't affect what's going on at the state. So there won't be a federal rule unless something changes. I guess that's probably just my take on it. I mean, it's surprising to see what could happen. But there's another court case in Britain that looks like the chances of the government supporting religious freedom are much worse.
So there's also a case like this happening in Britain, I guess. Can you just briefly tell us about that? Or same basic thing?
It is the same basic thing where there was a homosexual couple. They went through and found a Christian bakery. And in this case, they definitely have good evidence that it was specifically targeted. And they found this bakery, asked them to not make a wedding cake. They wanted a cake for a party, but they wanted like a picture of Bert and Ernie from Sesame Street on it with the slogan, "Support gay marriage." And so obviously the Christian couple who owned the bakery had a problem with that, and so they took them to the court, and the court ruled that they had to make the cake, and then they appealed it to the appeals court, and the appeals court ruled that they have to make the cake. And I guess the couple, Christian couple, had taken the stance that, well, we don't care what the court or the appeals court say, we're not making this cake. So they weren't really sure how they're going to force them to do that yet, but they've taken it to the Supreme Court of Britain, and they'll hear that case in April. So around about the same time, they'll probably hear the case here. So first part of this year, there's going to be Supreme Court ruling in both Britain and the United States on whether Christian bakers will be forced to make these cakes or not.
So looking at this issue more broadly, you mentioned an article that you wrote called "What's Going to Happen to Religious Freedom." What is your view of the future of religious freedom in these countries?
Right. Well, like I said, the case in Britain looks more negative in the short term. In the United States, the Trump administration does seem to be pushing back a little bit against some of the religious freedom violations that took place under the Obama administration, such as forcing employers to pay for contraception that they don't agree with religiously, or Planned Parenthood forcing employers to pay for abortions that they don't agree with. But I guess regardless of what happens in these two Supreme Court cases or with the Trump administration, we do know from the Bible that religious freedom is going to be on its way out the door for a short period, at least. there's a, I quote in that article this this verse from Matthew 24, where the disciples had come to Christ asking him what the sign of his second coming was going to be. And he said, well, take heed that no man deceives you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And then a few verses later in verse 9, it says, then they shall deliver you up to be afflicted, and they shall kill you, and you shall be hated in all nations for my name's sake. And this verse is specifically about true Christians. There's that same chapter also mentions that false Christianity is going to be another sign of Christ's imminent return. But in the case of the true Christians, you do know that you can't persecute true Christians and obey the U.S. Constitution at the same time. The Constitution protects the rights of those true Christians. Mm-hmm. And so for, and you said in all nations, America is not an exception to that. It is a nation.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that that persecution that you see in a lot of other nations, at least against the true Christians, is eventually going to work its way here. And for that to happen, the protections that the Constitutions give those Christians has to be eroded away. And it's hard to see necessarily exactly how that's going to happen. But this is just an example with this organized assault on the right of people to preach Bible verses against homosexuality in a public place, or to use your own ingredients in your own kitchen to bake a cake for some a wedding ceremony that's not biblically moral.
Yeah.
Shows that this is an assault that is eventually going to accumulate or climax in the destruction of religious freedom in the Western world.
It is remarkable to look at America's history and just how quickly in recent decades we've gone from being a nation that guaranteed religious freedom and freedom of religion within the United States. Many of the people who first settled on this continent, in this nation, did so specifically to escape religious persecution and being forced to practice religion in a certain way, or to not practice religion the way that they believed they should, by freedom of conscience, to the point where we're trying to enforce freedom from religion. This idea of separation of church and state has become a bludgeon against the practice and even the belief in certain religion or certain biblical morals, to the point where we are today, where we're seeing these legal battles take up more and more space in our courts, and there are more and more people who are deliberately aiming to erode those freedoms on every front that they can. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller on this subject and these instances where we're seeing individuals being prosecuted in the courts for obeying the dictates of their conscience according to their religion. He's working on an article, or we're working on an article that will appear on thetrumpet.com on this subject soon. You can also just check out his older article, What's Going to Happen to Religious Freedom. That's from our January 2017 edition of The Trumpet Magazine. Very interesting conversation. Thanks for that, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
New Year's resolutions. A lot of people make them. One study showed that 92% of those who do break them. And after not very long at all. In fact, last week, January 17th, has been humorously dubbed Ditch New Year's Resolution Day. Don't feel guilty for returning to life as usual. Trumpet writer Dennis Leap has written an article about this, and he says this might seem funny, but there's actually something worth thinking about here. That is, making positive changes in our lives is really important. We all really need to do this. We don't want to be dismissive about the process of breaking bad habits and forming good habits. We have him here in the studio to talk about this. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, always good to talk with you. So, first of all, we need to talk about the celebration of New Year's.
This is a holiday with
some really bad origins and some traditions that need to be mentioned. Can you just give us an overview there?
Well, yeah, a lot of times on Trumpet.com we talk about learning from history, and very few people really today understand why we actually even have a New Year's celebration. But if you look in the history, you can just go to history.com and start looking. And we know that Julius Caesar tweaked with the calendar that actually the new year was really around March, April. It was worldwide. And then the Roman Empire got involved and Julius Caesar changed it back to January 1st. But it also happens to be the in honor of the god Janus. You know, so they were actually worshiping a god Janus who had two faces, one looked backward, one looked forward. And so we know it was really kind of a debauched festival, a lot of drunkenness and sexual orgy and things like that. And I don't necessarily want to say that's the truth about New Year's, but there are aspects. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure there are some people celebrate it as a debauched festival, but I wouldn't say everyone does. But the thing is, that's really where the tradition of setting a New Year's resolution came from. It came from ancient Rome. And actually even goes back even further to Babylon. And the point is, I think there's two reasons why the resolution started. One, people felt guilty after the debauchery and decided they better change. But the second thing is if you look at the real truth spiritually, there is it's the same kind of season. If you look at the new year in terms of the Bible, it really is in March or April. Mm-hmm. It's the Passover season comes up, and it really is a time for self-examination. And I think this was the Roman excuse for, well, we can change this and do it our way. And they made it just a big celebration festival. But even if you look at it mentally, and there are a lot of people that they make their New Year's resolutions, New Year's Eve, and everyone gets around a table, and it kind of gets to be a joke. Now, I do think some people probably take it seriously.
Right.
But anything you decide in a situation like that, you're not going to really be that successful with. And of course, I talk about it in the article. You really have to have a mental focus, and you're not going to get that in a state of of inebriation. It's just not going to happen.
Sure.
So
you obviously with the practice of forming resolutions associated with that pagan holiday. We don't want to participate in that, but you do make an interesting point that that there is, even in the Christian tradition and in the Bible, there is this self-examination period and an effort to purify ourselves, clean up our lives that occur at the beginning of the new year, the sacred calendar, and the whole process of making positive change. There is a way to do this, and you talk about making the changes permanent. Let's just start by talking about why it can be so hard, because even the New Year's resolutions that a lot of the people are forming, it's probably I'm going to get more exercise, I'm going to improve my relationships, I'm going to improve my time management. These are worthwhile things to do. Why is it that we have so much trouble following through?
Well, one thing that's really interesting, of course, I've written some previous articles and on this happiness psychology. It's like, get happy. And the point is that human beings do need to make changes. We do all have faults. And, if we just let the faults continue to collect, then our lives are not going to be wholesome. We're not going to have a happy, life or a pleasant life. And there are times when you really do need to make a change. But it's interesting that there's a couple of psychologists are against the happy psychology. And the thing is, what they say, and again, I don't agree with everything they're writing in this book. It's called The Upside of Your Dark Side. But the thing I think is true is we really have become a society addicted to comfort. And if you're going to make a change in your life, it's not going to be comfortable. Mm-hmm. If you've gotten used to eating, overeating, to say you're going to stop overeating, it's going to take some pain to do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look at America and you look at Britain, you look at the, you know, our Western societies, we really do have so many comforts. I mean, even the whole idea of like drive-in, you know, the drive-in restaurants, you can drive in your car. You don't have to get out of your car. You don't have to walk anywhere. You drive up to the window, pay your money, walk in, and then you drive away with your food. I mean, that's a lot different than it was in America, you know, let's say in the 1700s, where you had to go out and work for your food,
yeah,
you know, kind of thing. So I think we really are, we've really gotten to be a soft society. And like they said, if you're really going to grow, and we should all be seeking personal growth. I mean, every one of us that are married probably have marriage problems and we need to make changes. Well, that's going to take some effort. You know, if you have been overeating and not exercising, it's going to take some effort to get started. It's not going to be, it's going to be somewhat painful. And like, the authors, you know, I'll just call them by their first name, Todd and Robert. And if you get the article, you can get the whole thing. But, you know, they said our forefathers were, you know, they were used to eating little dust, you know, being sunburnt, being, you know, rained on without an umbrella. And life was more interesting at times. So yeah. So we should be making personal changes. We should be growing. And, you know, but the reason we fail is, well, we don't want to suffer the pain that it's going to take.
So I am very confident that everybody who's listening to this interview has had those times where they've made a decision. They say, I'm going to make this change. I'm going to improve this area in my life. I'm going to stop doing this or start doing that, and subsequently failed. And, you know, people can make a joke about ditch New Year's resolution day, but the fact is that we all have had those times where it's like, wow, why can't I be more resolute to actually make those changes? Why do I keep falling back into the old ways? What would you tell the person who's at that point?
Well, one of the things I would definitely stress is that, I mean, there is a spiritual quality to making even physical changes. You know, if you're going to let's say you're going to lose weight, well, then you have to discipline yourself. I mean, that's you're going to have to do some evaluation. What am I eating? And there's so many things out there today, apps, and there's even DNA tests and all that can help you see what you need to change to, you know, to get yourself back under control, kind of thing. You know, so you have to do some really self-evaluation that way and say, okay, you could be eating late dinners at 10 o'clock at night and going to bed. That's not going to help your weight loss. You could be eating an excess of chips. You know, you could be eating a lot of high fat foods, you know, those kind of things. So it really is kind of a spiritual quality of discipline and will to say, well, I'm going to stop doing that until I get myself under control. And then if I go back to it, I'm going to do it in a moderate way. So we're talking about temperance in many things, even a lack of exercise. You know, the human body is physical. It needs to be exercised to stay in tone and in shape. And it doesn't have to be, you know, where you have to go buy a gym membership and do all that and spend a lot of money. You could just start, you know, start walking, you know, start moving, you know, things like that. So there really is, in some ways, there is some real spiritual character there. And even Ben Franklin got into those things. He talked about being temperate. He talked about, you know, not overeating to excess. He talked about not over drinking where you're drowsy all the time. And those are real character issues.
Yeah. Man. Well, you make this this point in the article. I'll just read a little bit of this. You can make changes successfully when you're willing to put in the effort to do so. You need not fail. How do we know this? It's revealed in the Holy Bible. Did you know that God created mankind as a physical being so that we could successfully make changes in our personal lives? Maybe you could just talk about that a little bit. The fact that God made us physical, that we are subject to change, that this is kind of part of this process of improvement that we need to go through.
Right. I mean, if you look at it, and of course, some people will disagree with our observation of it, but But it says very clearly, and I remember even as a boy being told by, you know, wise aunts, you know, you're made of the dust of the ground. Well, if you look at all the materials that we, I mean, our whole society is built out of materials from the ground, and look how it can be fashioned and changed. Mm. Well, the human body is made the same way. And the thing is really the whole plan of God. It's kind of like a school down here. And, you know, even to be educated, you have to change. You have to change the way you think. Sometimes you think wrong. So here, really, God instilled in us, we're made out of the dust of the ground. Now it's flesh, but look how it transformed. So we can change. You can make changes. And but again, it's going to take, you know, some self-evaluation, and then you know, it's going to take some desire on your part. And then even people I know that necessarily aren't that, let's say they don't necessarily associate with the church, but they know they need the change, and they actually go to prayer and they make the changes. I mean, you can make changes, you know, if you're having a, you know, a destructive marriage, you can make changes there. Mm-hmm. It can be done. It might take some counseling to do it, but you're going to have to change the way you do things, and that takes character.
Yeah. We actually have a booklet written by the publisher and the editor-in-chief of the Trumpet magazine that's called How to Be an Overcomer that emphasizes this very thing, and it's got seven chapters with some really deep, profound, penetrating subject matter in how do you actually follow through with this. And he talks about this spirit dimension. Obviously, there's, you know, every website, life hacker blog out there that will tell you these are the things that you need to do in order to actually make positive changes in your life. And still, if you're trying to do that, just kind of summoning the willpower that you have within you, you're going to bump up against a brick wall in a lot of cases. It's very, very difficult, where there is a spiritual dimension to this, and you can actually draw on resources beyond yourself in order to help you to make those changes.
Yeah, in many ways you have to. You know, we're all put in, you know, some, you know, we've all collected some bad habits, some of them we've collected from our parents, some we've, you know, collected just growing
bad
up.
Bad choices,
you know. But the thing is, we don't have to stay that way. No one has to stay that way. And that is so many people even are defeated before they even start. They say, well, this is just the way I am. Well, God didn't intend us to stay just the way I am. And there's actually some false view in religion that way. You know, well, take me just as I am. Well, No. You know, you need to make some changes. Yeah. And I think there is a spirit. There's a God spirit. There's a spirit world. There's a negative spirit world, but I think there's also a very positive, righteous one that's willing to help you make the changes if you really want to.
Yeah. Well, we sure appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Dennis Leap about how to make positive permanent changes in your life, in contrast with ditch your New Year's resolution day. And the fact that I think, 80% of the people, they've already dropped their resolutions by about this time.
Yeah, second week in February, it's like they're over. But, you know, it was funny. I was just traveling in Washington, D.C., and I was listening to talk radio, and this was like the January 2nd, and I listened to several different ones, and they were all just laughing about how they've already ditched their resolutions. You know, I mean, they made them the 31st of December, and this is January 2nd, and they said, it's already over.
Right. But so, there is a really important truth here, and something that really is worth contemplating, and that is that we do need to make these changes in our lives. He's written an article about this. You can check it out on thetrumpet.com. It's Ditch Your New Year's Resolution Day, and points to some of these spiritual truths. And I'd also really encourage you, if you're listening to this, to check out Gerald Fleury's booklet, How to Be an Overcomer. That is an in-depth booklet. It's something 80, 90 pages with seven chapters, a lot in there about this subject that show the spiritual dimension. It's way beyond anything that you're going to find on any other self-help type book or life hacker blog.
And it's free.
And it's free.
And you don't have to go buy this expensive piece of DIM equipment.
Yeah, you can just go onto thetrumpet.com, look under library, and in the books and booklet section, if you look under all that, you'll find that booklet, How to Be an Overcomer. At any rate, it's been great talking with you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, and look forward to the next time.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Let's talk about baby food. It's an exciting time when your baby is getting weaned and ready to try some real food. And of course, as parents, we want that food to help make them strong and healthy. We want to put them in the best position for strong development, long-term health. When you think about store-bought food, store-bought baby food, there's a lot that is mysterious about the actual ingredients in that food. Some of these products have leached in chemicals. They have questionably sourced additives. There's a lot that can go wrong when you're looking for baby or toddler food on the store shelves. And there might even be items in that food that don't make it onto the label. To talk about this, we have holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. We appreciate you joining us. So this is definitely a subject that would have a real practical impact on some of our listeners. First of all, what's the best food for a baby?
Well, the best food for a baby is always breast milk. I mean, it has some serious advantages over any commercial variety. Number one would be it's free. You can't get better than that. And it also contains a lot of components, over 200 components that you won't get in commercial foods. And these will play a role in the general development and growth of the baby, of course. Even if you look at bacteria in the colon of the baby, it takes about a year to really get that bacteria in place and then make sure that baby has a chance to really digest the solid foods later on. Well, breast milk specifically encourages that the beneficial bacteria growth. And in fact, you know, breastfed infants have a level of bacteria that's 10 times greater than that of formula-fed babies. Nice. So that's really significant because it leads to a lot less illness and as well as a lot less deaths in babies in a first year.
Oh, that is phenomenal. So, well, let's just talk about the comparisons between the natural food that God intends a baby to have and what you might find on the store shelves. Because it is amazing to me how hard it is pushed to get your baby onto formula quickly in a lot of cases. But in a lot of these products, they have sugars and things that aren't beneficial, that really can be quite harmful and prevent the development that you're talking about. Tell us what are some of the dangers of commercial baby foods?
Sure. Well, first I'd like to state that there are some mothers who cannot breastfeed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's unfortunate there's always going to be some problems, but those are the minority. And if we look at manufacturers, they really try to push solid foods at about 3 or 4 months already, and that's not right. You know, because we're lacking. First of all, let's look at the nutrition in these foods. The studies are finding that there's a lot of nutrients missing for these little babies. And when you look at the development and growth of these babies, what they need, if they're lacking that, of course, we're going to have a lot of problems. A good thing is that there's a lot of organic ingredients now going into baby foods, and we should be looking at that. But that still doesn't mean that there isn't a long way to go with health. Because a lot of them are processed with high heat, you know, and so they're going to have problems showing up there. A lot of them have a high amount of sugar in them. And we know that a baby getting that high sugar, it's going to start to really want that taste of that. And they'll start getting all fussy with it if they don't have it. But as well, we're seeing babies that are having diabetes really quickly now.
That's amazing.
You know, so they had a study in the archives of diseases in childhood that said out of 479 formulas that they looked at, 65% were sweetened.
Right.
So another thing is you're going to find a lot of unsavory ingredients because baby food is really a dumping ground, just like any other processed food. And we don't look at it as a processed food, but it is.
Yeah.
So you're going to get industrial vegetable oils. You're going to get corn syrup. You're going to get preservatives, thickeners, emulsifiers, refined flours. When you're looking at a small child, this isn't what they need in those early years, you know?
Yeah.
So, and as well, these ingredients, because you have to add these into the food, you have to, it dilutes the nutrition content and it reduces the value for the money as well for the parent and for the health of the babies.
This seems like this is really the fact that we don't tend to look at food for its nutritional value nearly as much as we do other factors, predominantly taste, but also cost. And we're basically concerned about, you know, filling that hole in our belly, stopping the hunger pangs with whatever is most pleasing to the palate. That's the mindset that we have as adults. And so we're taking that same kind of thinking into the food that we're producing and that we're serving to our youngest children, when really the just developmentally, those early months and years are really crucial to the lifetime health of that individual.
Exactly. The problem is we place too much trust in these companies. And what I find with a lot of people is, say, they go through the supermarket and they start putting foods in there. They're not reading the back of the label.
Yeah.
And that's really shocking to me. Okay, so an adult body can get away with a lot more than a small child. But we should never trust a company that's in it for profit, you know, because if we don't read the back, we're going to get in big trouble with these children. Heavy metals is another thing about these foods. What people don't realize now is with the way we do trade today, we get ingredients from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to think, well, this is just a mom and pop thing, and it's coming down, a few states down from my country. It's not. You can get one ingredient from Poland, one ingredient from across the world. And they really source ingredients that are as cheap as possible. And we don't even know what's all in there because they don't all get tested. So Ellipse Analytics, it's a lab in Denver. They looked at it. They teamed up with a Clean Label Project. And it was a big, big study. And they tested 700 baby foods. And I was actually shocked. 35% of the samples tested positive for lead.
Whoa.
Lead. You know, so I'm thinking, where's the oversight in this?
And you're never going to see lead on a nutrition label. You're talking about elements that are in the food that would never even show up on the label.
Exactly. And this is shocking. The Environmental Defense Fund also found 20% of baby food samples over 10 years. You know, so it's not just one company doing that. And what we don't take into account is that the current standards for children don't reflect the latest science, because we tend to base the science on the adult body. So we say the adult body can take so much of a contaminant.
Yeah.
But we don't look at a small baby like that. So we're tossing them into the studies for adults. And what happens is these little children, their IQ and their ability to pay attention and their academic achievement suffers because they have these ingredients such as lead in there.
So it's having effects on their body that are far more severe than what would test on the kinds of people who would actually be subject to those tests.
Of course. I mean, it's not just that. It's arsenic, cadmium. You know, it's all kinds of chemicals that can cause cancer and brain damage later on. And this is proven through studies. Arsenic is another big one that was found in a Consumer Reports study. I mean, these are foods that we're feeding our babies because we're not taking care enough to read the labels. First of all, we shouldn't just buy anything that's not organic. Organic is a higher standard. But even in organic, we're finding that there's problems with chemicals. So, you know, it accumulates over time with those small children.
So, in other words, you certainly want to take every step that you can in order to prevent the worst of these kinds of problems from being introduced into your child's system. But there's only so much that you can do.
Well, we can do a lot. I mean, for myself, my children, what we did is we started with making our own foods, you know, after the breastfeeding period.
Yeah.
So we went as long as possible. We went about a year on the breastfeeding. We introduced some solids because you can tell when the child wants to experiment with the solids. But we kept at least 50% of the breastfeeding my wife kept up until the end of the first year. And then we started with healthy organic products for the solid foods, making it ourselves and keeping it nutritious, you know. So when a child transitions from the breastfeeding to solid, start with fresh fruits, you know, mangoes, apples, or carrots, something that has sweets in it. Or you could cook or puree whole grains.
Okay.
And that's very easy to make. And as the baby starts looking for salty or sour foods, you know, introduce citrus or cabbage or dark leafy greens, avocado, stuff like that. And the baby will start to really enjoy those foods. And you know that that's the type of food that's going to be healthy for the baby. Homemade options will be time consuming. I'm just not going to, you know.
There's no way around that.
No, there's not. But there's no unhealthy mystery ingredients.
Right.
And that's what I like about them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you could definitely see not only would you be establishing a better nutritional and health foundation in that child's life, but even the palate, educating the palate to enjoy and appreciate, say, a piece of fresh fruit or an avocado or something like that, a vegetable versus something that's got a lot of processed ingredients in it.
Well, common sense tells you if a child is brought up on sweetened baby foods, a commercial sweetened baby food, it's gonna develop that taste, that taste for a very rich, thick, high sugar, high salt, sometimes palate, and it's gonna get really fussy. Babies who are brought up on natural foods develop the taste for that, and they. You know, their palates are very sensitive and they start to really enjoy those natural foods. And then you just lead them into the later years where they actually say, remember those foods and they accept them naturally instead of being fussy about them.
Yeah. So one of the main points that you tend to stress as a nutritionist with all of your clients, and this is true for really all of us, is the more that we can eat that is unprocessed, the more we can stay away from processed foods, the more we can stay away from those products that even have a nutrition label on them, the better off we're going to be. And what you're saying here is that prescription begins from day one in a person's life.
Right. You look at in your baby's eyes, I remember that, you know, they have those little eyes and they look at you, you have this unconditional love and they have to trust you as the parent to make those decisions. One of my concerns is that when you research this, it's always, well, make sure that you're feeding the baby good foods when you make your own food. It's always going to be better in commercial foods.
Yeah.
Of course, we're going to put together different types of foods. So we're going to have the vegetables and the fruits and the healthy fats in there, you know, make sure that the baby gets that. But we have to look at commercial foods and say they're already going to be deficient. Roughly 60 to 70% in nutrients. How much worse are we going to do feeding them naturally and foods that we make up ourselves? Nutrition is always important in life, and it's never more so than for a small baby.
Yeah. Well, it is remarkable just how much we're seeing the rise in disease. You mentioned diabetes taking place in young people, early onset diabetes, and even other chronic conditions occurring in younger and younger years. And when you look at what so many of these young people are being nourished on, it becomes a little clearer why we're seeing the increase in incidence of those types of diseases.
That's correct. We're starting them on processed foods in the earliest years. of course, their bodies aren't going to develop the same way as wholesome foods.
Yeah.
And they're going to start developing their problems early on in life. I mean, colicky, just having that colicky baby, that has a lot to do with the gut bacteria. If you nourish that in that first year, that comes up, and you really do your job with that, you have a lot less problems with that. Mm-hmm. That child's going to grow up to be happy, healthy. It's going to be have a better IQ, be able to have a better attention span, and the body grows up nice and strong and sturdy rather than sickly.
Yeah. Well, that's marvelous. We certainly appreciate the information and the very practical tips that we can apply in raising our kids to be strong and healthy and giving them the nutrition that they need to develop in a healthy way. We've been talking with holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian. He's working on an article on this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Jörg, as always, thanks so much for your time. I know a lot of our listeners really do appreciate these segments.
It's been a pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
Some dietitians claim breakfast is the most important meal of your day. Others say it's the midday meal. But let's look beyond the nutritional benefits or the metabolic benefits. Let's make the case for dinner being most important, specifically family dinner. The tradition of eating dinner together as a family is getting rarer and rarer. The modern world has pushed the stay-at-home mom into the workforce. It's replaced her home-cooked meals with fast food and frozen dinners and takeout. Parents are working longer hours. Extracurricular activities can pull the teens away in the evenings. Kids have gotten used to foraging for snacks at all hours instead of eating real meals. And personal technology has a lot of family members retiring in their own worlds, even when they live under the same roof. Whatever the reasons, studies show that fewer than one-third of all children have a sit-down dinner with both parents on any given night. That's quite a loss. Family supplies the most precious relationships we have. And it's not easy to weave a family into a unified team. It doesn't happen automatically. It takes time. It takes effort. And probably nothing builds that bond like the daily rhythm of joining together at table. When a family breaks bread, its members are nourished not just by the food, but also by the company that they share. It does take effort. You've got to coordinate schedules. You have to forego competing claims on your time and attention. And ideally, you have to get some ingredients and cook some food. But it is effort well worth making. For one thing, a homemade family dinner tends to be a lot healthier than what you would eat otherwise. One Harvard Medical School study said it didn't even know what kind of food was consumed, and it still found that people who eat dinner with the family on most days or every day are 15% less likely to be overweight. That's pretty substantial. But if you're eating really nutritious food, you're going to have benefits that are even far greater in not getting sick, having more energy, having better health. But beyond that, amid the busyness of your day-to-day, your evening meal should be a welcome coming together among family members. It creates a sense of connection and belonging, emotional grounding and balance that can stabilize the lives of every member of the family, especially the younger ones. This value is actually measurable. One Columbia University study found that teens in families that almost never eat together, they're 72% likelier than the average teen to use illegal drugs, cigarettes, alcohol. Those who eat dinner with their parents fewer than three times a week are likelier to smoke and drink than those who eat with their parents six times a week. So clearly, family meals enable parents to get involved with their children and build a strong bond that children can lean on. There was a while back where I realized that my family was not eating together many nights of the week. My kids were involved in different activities. Our schedules conflicted. People were just helping themselves at their own opportunity to dinner. And I decided this is going to change. We studied the family schedule. We found at least a 20-minute window each night, and it was at a different time every night, but it was there where we could eat together. The positive effects of this change were excellent, and they were immediate. I think it's been the single best thing that we've ever done to build more cohesion and unity in our family. Family dinner also provides opportunity to teach your children to eat properly. Now, this is a really big need. If you just watch school children eat among themselves, or even with adults present, you see some pretty unrefined eating habits. Manners at the table are a small but significant part of the politeness and respectability and civility that we really do need to teach our children. Children and adults, we all need the reinforcement of good table manners that can occur only when a family eats together regularly. Now, if family dinners are the day's most important meal, what is the most important ingredient at those dinners? Well, that ingredient is love. Proverbs 15:17 says it's better to have a dinner of herbs where love is than a fatted ox and hatred with it. So even a meager dinner is enjoyable if you're having that in good company. When both parents go to work, when children go to school, you need that time each night to gather, to converse about the day, to connect and share and listen and laugh and strengthen the bonds of unity and love. On top of that, it's even a chance to grow in conversational skill, to learn how to give and contribute to a lively discussion. I know there was a time shortly after we started having those dinners, I realized that we really needed to improve our conversation at the dinner table. And I asked every member to come ready with some points of discussion, bring a joke, a question, a story from their day, a current event, that type of thing. That immediately changed what had been a rather stilted mealtime chatting into robust conversation. And it wasn't long before we didn't need to require prepared topics. Everybody got used to thinking of things that they could share over dinner. So that exercise, not only did it prove our skill at conversing, it did something more wonderful than that. It helped us learn to enjoy each other. We began sharing ourselves more and laughing together more, even learning how to poke fun and to laugh at ourselves more in love. And we began more freely discussing plans and things to do together. I didn't anticipate these benefits, but they were there and they were priceless. Savor those family dinners. Make them a vital part of your family life. Take full advantage of this most important meal of the day. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests on the program today, Andrew Miller, Dennis Leap, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Oliver Wendell Holmes. To be 70 years young is sometimes far more cheerful and hopeful than to be 40 years old. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.